Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present BBC investigative reporter and author Greg Pallast, who discusses his investigation into the missing ballots in November's election and explains why he believes that if all the votes were counted, John Kerry would have won the presidency. Bruce Ackerman, professor of constitutional law at Yale University, who examines the flaws in the U.S. electoral system, including the installation of partisan state officials to oversee voter registration and ballot counting. And Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners magazine, who assesses the issue of moral values as expressed by voters in the 2004 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Fearing an upsurge of violence in western Darfur, aid agencies, including the United Nations World Food Program, are evacuating staff and shutting down operations in the war-torn region of Sudan. According to Reuters, the World Food Program team left Jebel Mara district after rebels fighting the Islamic government in Khartoum took 18 Arab hostages off a bus in October and ambushed a convoy carrying senior Sudanese officials. By leaving the region, international aid groups have abandoned 160,000 refugees who rely on food aid to survive. In mid-October, the World Food Program also pulled out of northern Darfur after two aid workers with Save the Children were killed by a landmine. Overall, the UN estimates that 70,000 people have died in Darfur since March from disease and malnutrition, and 1.5 million people have been forced to flee their homes in the wake of brutal attacks by the pro-government Janjaweed militias. However, in a recent breakthrough, on November 9th, Sudan and the rebel faction signed two agreements that give aid groups full access to all refugees. The government also signed off on a no-fly zone that bans military aircraft from rebel-controlled areas. The agreement was mediated by the African Union, which will soon put over 3,000 troops and police on the ground in the disputed region of Sudan to monitor the still uncertain peace accord. A study published in the current issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist documents a growing global stockpile of plutonium and highly enriched uranium. According to the report's authors, David Albright, a former United Nations weapons inspector, and Kimberly Kramer of the Institute for Science and International Security, there's a worldwide stockpile of 3,700 metric tons of nuclear fuel, enough material to make hundreds of nuclear weapons in nearly 60 countries. Most of the existing nuclear fuel is in Russia, followed by the United States. Materials are also stored in declared nuclear states such as Britain, France, China, Japan, Germany, the Netherlands, and South Africa. This stored fuel is monitored by the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. North Korea, which pulled out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 2003, has developed 15 to 39 kilograms of plutonium, enough to build between 2 to 9 nuclear weapons, according to the study. Plutonium stocks are also growing in Israel, Pakistan, and India, nations that have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and are not subject to IAEA inspections. Meanwhile, coastal nations such as New Zealand and Peru protest the lack of security in transporting nuclear materials through their territorial waters. They say that the potentially dangerous cargoes go through local waterways without their prior knowledge. Each year, Tyson Foods cleans out its egg-laying factories. This routine is bad news for nearby residents who must endure ammonia fumes and bird feather dust, along with a flood of mice that can overrun the neighborhood. As Faye Lear of White Plains, Kentucky complained, "It's nauseating, it burns your eyes. I can't call them a farm, they're like an industry." According to the news magazine In These Times, factory farms that warehouse chickens, hogs, and cows each year produce 1.3 billion tons of waste that creates toxic emissions. Despite the growing number of lawsuits against producers, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is seeking voluntary agreements with the poultry industry to set up air pollution monitoring. In these agreements, the EPA will grant each cooperating factory farm a 2-year amnesty in exchange for monitoring its emissions. Only later will producers be penalized for violating clean air and toxic waste standards. But many producers deny they create any health problems. As Kara Flynn of the National Pork Producers Council quipped, "I travel frequently to hog farms and I never smelled anything that caused me any grief. It was, actually, quite pleasant." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As voters cast their ballots for president on November 2nd, exit pollsters reported that Democrat John Kerry held a decisive lead in many of the key battleground states. The news of an impending Kerry victory derived from the exit polls buoyed his supporters and depressed those backing the Bush campaign. But as election night wore on and votes were counted in the crucial state of Ohio, it became clear that President Bush, not Kerry, would be the victor. Senator Kerry conceded the election just 12 hours after his running mate John Edwards had promised supporters that the Democratic candidates would fight to ensure that every vote would be counted. But disturbing questions about how the election was conducted are gathering momentum around the country. Journalists and activists are now looking into reports that tens of thousands of ballots, cast primarily by people of color, were improperly thrown out after being labeled as spoiled. Other questions involve miscounts in favor of the president made by electronic voting machines and GOP election tactics employed to suppress the Democratic vote through a variety of means. A pattern of anomalies in some Florida counties operating with optical scanning machines, which saw Democratic Party majority districts overwhelmingly vote for President Bush, is also being investigated. Several Democratic congressional representatives have sent a letter to the General Accounting Office requesting an inquiry into voting irregularities. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with BBC television reporter Greg Palast, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, whose investigations uncovered a Republican purge of tens of thousands of voters in the 2000 Florida election. Palast discusses his investigation into the 2004 election and explains why he believes that if all the votes were counted, John Kerry would have won the presidency.
The exit polls called it for Kerry because most people thought that they voted for Kerry. The official count is not the full count. In Ohio, 250,000 ballots have not been counted, which is pretty funny for a democracy. We have 136,000 votes officially for George Bush in the lead, but whose votes are they that aren't counted? Well, they're very dark colored. That is, these are mostly African-American votes. How do we know that? About 200,000 votes are so-called provisional ballots, and these are the result of a massive challenge campaign run by the Republican Party in Ohio. The first attempt in 50 years since the end of the Jim Crow period for a concerted campaign to block African Americans from voting literally by the hundreds of thousands. And the Republican Party came up with this challenge concept as a way. Obviously, it's not a question of whether they like black voters or dislike them. This is a question of not liking the color of their vote. But it may be, one thing that has to be addressed is whether this may be illegal under the Voting Rights Act. And remember, in the Jim Crow period, there were no laws that said black people couldn't vote. But in 1965, the Voting Rights Act recognized that in southern states, they were using laws, little technicalities in the laws, to bar black voters because the laws were only applied to black voters. And this is what we saw in Ohio. So you have up to a quarter million provisional ballots, mostly African Americans, not counted in Ohio, and few will be. We have a second group of ballots, the punch card ballots, which could not be read by machines. We are back to hanging chads again in Ohio. People aren't discussing this. 73% of the votes cast in Ohio were cast on old, decrepit punch card machines without any type of scanning device which could tell you if your vote could not be read by a machine. That has resulted in 93,000 ballots being thrown out because you have hanging chads or pregnant chads, etc. Now, whose votes are they? We know because the ACLU did an extremely careful study of the last several elections in Ohio and has sued the state under the Voting Rights Act saying most of these ballots are cast in black neighborhoods. Why? Not because blacks don't know how to punch a hole or they're weaker than white people and can't punch all the way through a ballot. It's that they're given the worst machines. Just like they got the worst schools and worst hospitals, they get the worst machines. So now let's add it back up. Provisional ballots, nearly 250,000 in Ohio, overwhelmingly in Democratic areas. Those are Democratic votes. 93,000 punch cards in the garbage can. Those are overwhelmingly Democratic minority votes. You add them together and you've swamped George Bush's nominal victory margin in Ohio of 136,000 votes, which also has to be reduced by known computer glitches. That 136, we have to now knock off at least 4,000 for votes in a county where there were 4,000 more votes cast for George Bush than there were voters.
What's the Democratic Party doing about this, Greg? They had an army of lawyers out there on Election Day. Have they all been called back home? Is anybody left in the field to challenge this?
Well, that's one of the great shames here. John Kerry cited my studies showing that 1 million black votes were not counted in the 2000 election. Kerry said, this time that must not happen, 1 million black votes uncounted. But, of course, his decision means that, again, 1 million black votes, maybe more this time, won't be counted. And what I mean by that is, unless he's ready to fight over every provisional ballot, they're not going to get counted except for a small minority. And unless he demands a recount, or not a recount, but a count, a hand count of the spoiled ballots, they will never be counted. In other words, the Republicans were very good last time making fun of hanging chads. What a hanging chad is, someone tried to vote for President of the United States, but a little piece of that hole stuck to the back of the ballot, and they lost their vote for president. That's a civil rights issue because it's black people who were stuck with those crappy ballots. Now, John Kerry, to win Ohio, would have to argue against the Secretary of State of Ohio over every single provisional ballot, over every single dimpled chad. And ultimately, those arguments would go to the Supreme Court, and they've already voted, and we know which way they would vote again. So from Kerry's calculus, he didn't stand a chance. He had the votes, but he had no chance of having them counted.
Just a final question, Greg. There are a lot of people in this country that are outraged, to say the least, dissatisfied with the way our electoral system has worked, the mechanics of it, the fact that all these ballots are spoiled, that votes aren't counted, electronic voting machines have no paper trail to recount votes accurately. What are our options here, do you think?
We need something new in America, which is a democratic culture. We have to get back to the idea that all votes have to be counted, and it don't go nyeh, nyeh, nyeh. We found a technicality. And we have to make a decision that we have to end what is effectively an apartheid vote counting system in America. And that just got to end. And we have to talk about it. John Kerry began talking about it, but then, you know, he only talked about it when he was in front of the NAACP and the Congressional Black Caucus. And unless you start talking about the apartheid vote counting system in America before white audiences, making this an issue for all people, it ain't going to change.
That was Greg Palast, an investigative reporter with BBC Television. Read Palast's columns online and get more information about his new film documentary, Bush Family Fortunes, by visiting his website at www.gregpalast.com. Although it appears that George W. Bush won the presidential election with a majority of electoral votes and about 3 million more votes than his opponent, the election also revealed deep, perhaps fatal flaws in the linchpin of American democracy, the concept that everyone's vote counts equally. Watchdog groups documented problems with voter intimidation, so-called lost ballots, and millions of ballots that were cast on electronic voting machines with no paper trail. One flaw that underlies many of the nation's electoral problems is that the guarantor in each state of a citizen's right to vote, the Secretary of State, is a partisan political operative. This was made starkly clear in Florida's 2000 election when Secretary of State Katherine Harris served simultaneously as candidate George W. Bush's campaign co-chair. The same thing occurred this year in the critical state of Ohio, where Republican Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell served as co-chair of President Bush's re-election campaign in that state. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bruce Ackerman, professor of constitutional law at Yale University School of Law, about the origins of the American system, which has partisan officials overseeing the electoral process, and explains how other nations surpass the U.S. when it comes to running fair and transparent elections.
In many states, the governor appoints a partisan to the Secretary of Stateship, and in many others, it's an elected party office. This is a silly idea to have a partisan official counting the votes. It just is silly. And it's an inheritance of the 19th century when we were at the forefront of universal suffrage, and we only had corrupt bureaucrats, really, until the latter part of the 19th century, no proper civil service. Throughout the world, if you look at things throughout the world, you'll find that there are about 75 countries now that have independent electoral commissions. These are full-time pros whose only job, really, it is to run an honest ballot, an honest count. And they are one of the great institutional innovations since the Second World War. And that's the way a place like India, for example, which is one of the most corrupt countries in the world, has honest ballot counts. It was really pretty embarrassing once in the middle of the 2000 election. I was Al Gore's representative in Florida. And I said, coming out of the Florida legislature, you know, we've been reduced to a banana republic. After this incautious remark was, you know, sent around the world, I got all these emails from friends of mine in lots of places around the world saying, what are you talking about? We run our elections in a much more professional fashion than you do. And that's the honest truths. But this basic structural inadequacy, which is true of every state in the union, that we have a partisan official running the election machinery, has to be changed. And Congress has authority to do it.
So has there been any motion or any movement by anybody in Congress to take up this question?
No. The Republican Congress is all strong on states' rights. They watered down the Voting Reform Act of 2002, Help America Vote Act, because of these states' rights concerns. It's conceivable, I would suppose, that in all 50 states we did a serious job in reforming the system, but not too likely.
Talk a little more about the HAVA, the Help America Vote Act. You said that the Republicans in Congress watered that down. What were some of the proposals that didn't make it into the law?
A lot more regulation of the process, clearer statements as to what the provisional ballot process would look like. But they didn't get to the heart of the problem, which is this partisan administration of elections, which Americans just take for granted. And that's why they didn't get to the heart of the problem. It's an interesting fact of history that in the 19th century, the Republican Congresses, after the Civil War, confronting massive vote fraud in Tammany Hall and other places, did enact a statute, which was repealed 20 years later, for an honest vote count in the states, because they were constantly being burned by Tammany Hall discovering 100,000 votes for the Democratic candidate. And so there is actual precedent for strong federal supervision of the voting process in the United States. We have to rediscover our past. I myself believe that George Bush won the election.
This election.
That's right. And I myself do not think that it's profitable at all to engage in imagining otherwise. But this problem is going to hit us again. We haven't done anything fundamental about it. And 2008 or 12 or 16, the world might be even worse. People might be even more bitterly divided than they are today. And then suddenly, partisan manipulation will destroy the legitimacy of the outcome. It's something that we should confront, and I'm afraid that we won't, because Congress won't, and 50 states, that's a very difficult job.
Could it be done? Could states individually change? I guess they're in charge of elections, right? So they could change whatever they wanted.
Absolutely. Definitely, states could do this. And let's get moving.
That was Yale Law School professor Bruce Ackerman. For more information on electoral reforms, call the Center for Voting and Democracy at area code 301-270-4616 or visit the group's website at www.fairvote.org. After casting their ballots on November 2nd, a sampling of voters were questioned about the issues important to them. Pollsters reported that the 22% of U.S. voters who named moral values as their primary issue supported President Bush by an overwhelming 79%. Opposition to abortion and gay marriage were among the issues most important to these voters. After John Kerry conceded the election to Mr. Bush, the media and the pundits focused like a laser beam on the perceived moral values gap between the Democratic and Republican parties. In the aftermath of their defeat, elected Democrats and party officials joined in the hand-wringing and the search for answers as to why they were unable to connect with Americans living in the red state heartland. Some commentators went so far as to suggest that because gay marriage was such a losing issue for Democrats, they should abandon their fight to extend equal rights and protections for gay and lesbian citizens. Many progressives, fearing that Democrats would now swing to the right in order to win future elections, cautioned that a belief in moral values should incorporate a rejection of unjust wars, support for policies to overcome poverty, and protection of the environment. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Jim Wallace, a longtime social justice religious activist and editor of Sojourners magazine. He assesses the issue of moral values as expressed by voters in the 2004 presidential election and offers advice on new ways to reach out to voters whose politics are driven by fear and rejection of the unfamiliar.
Well, this is the kind of election that no matter what the outcome would be, half the population would feel crushed. The country is that divided. I think this question of moral values that became the exit poll discussion, I welcome the conversation about values. I think the future of American politics may be a conversation about values. The question is what values and whose moral values and what are we talking about? And I'm a Christian, and a Christian who cared about peace would have answered that question by checking, you know, the war in Iraq as their top concern. A Catholic coordinator of a soup kitchen would have checked the closest thing he could find to poverty would have been the economy. And so those are both moral values, too, and they weren't listed in the moral values question. So I think we need a deeper, fuller, richer conversation about values, and I think we might be able to even find some more common ground than we saw on this election night. You know, we saw a lot of manipulation of values and even religion being used in a very partisan kind of way, as if all of our religious values could be shrunk or boiled down to just two issues, you know, the gay marriage issue and the abortion question, which were very important to some voters, but poverty is a religious issue too, and so is the environment, and so is the war in Iraq. So I think we needed a debate, a deeper, wider debate, and that's, I think, the future now, to have a real good conversation about what those religious and moral values are that might be a compass for our politics.
Reverend Wallace, why do you think the war in Iraq, cutting taxes for the rich while cutting programs for the poor, attacks on regulations protecting the environment, why were those not seen by many of the voters who answered those exit poll questions as moral values issues?
Well, I even think some of the people who voted for the moral values question do see some of those issues as important. There were millions of Christians in this country who thought the war in Iraq was not a just war. I want to see what the voters who said protecting innocent lives were a value to them. I want to see what they say now about what happens in Fallujah. We're about to see the loss of lots of innocent lives with the U.S. military assault. And so I think we have to be consistent in our values here. And so the truth is neither candidate, neither party really championed poverty or poor people during this election campaign. And really, you know, John Kerry didn't focus a lot of real moral distinction in the war in Iraq. He challenged how the war was being fought, but he didn't really raise it as a fundamental moral question. So we really haven't had the debate a lot of people were hoping for about health care, about jobs, about what's happening to working families. And so in the absence of a debate, this was an election where they a lot of talk about faith, a lot of talk about fear. And I think both questions, sadly, were manipulated, and that was a part of the reason for the result.
Many voters in this country distrust politicians, and maybe one of the primary reasons they distrust them is this view that they triangulate, they pander, they have some kind of transparent political positioning strategy, which doesn't have much to do with their core values, but, you know, winning the critical number of votes to gain victory. People smell that, I think. And where do you think politics has to go in this country so that core values on either side are more represented in our campaigns, in our national dialogue around elections?
Well, I'm not one that looks to politicians to do much of that, frankly. What changes history, what changes society are social movements that have some kind of a spiritual or moral foundation to them. And then politics responds to those movements. That's what the civil rights movement was all about. So I think it's time to look at how to build those kind of movements. If we build the kind of movements that really can change the political wind, then I think the politicians can and do respond. I think, for example, there's some common ground, new common ground, to be found on the poverty issue in particular. And people who voted both ways in this election, I think, could be called upon to take seriously some basic facts, like the average age of a homeless person now in Chicago, I was just there, is 9 years old. And half of the world's people live on less than $2 a day. So there are some basic fundamental realities that I think could bring people together across some of these other social divides. And it would be wonderful to have some political leaders who would try to find that common ground. But I think we can't rely on the political leaders to lead us in that direction. I think this is where we have to take responsibility for ourselves and the movements that we can create and already are creating, and then politics can respond accordingly. I'm really amazed at some of the efforts occurring across the country, day in, day out, that are feeding people, housing people, sheltering people. And what I'm saying to those folks, some of them faith-based, some of them not, but all doing this for reasons of conscience. What I'm saying to a lot of them is, let's not keep pulling bodies out of the river, but send somebody upstream to see water who's throwing them in. And if we could begin to magnify the collective voice of the people doing that work on the ground, I think we could make some real progress.
That was Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine. Contact Sojourners by calling area code 202-328-8842. Or read Reverend Wallace's commentaries online at www.sojo.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.